It's Wednesday, February 28th, 2018, which happens to be Tynes Esther and Masoret. Okay, before we get back to the general topic, it's always good to have a little bit of a change of pace. And the question, Jesse texted me two questions. One pertains to Purim, but one is a general question. And there's a statement of Chazal that shluchei mitzvah ein nizukin. Translated loosely, it means that the people who are on a mission of doing a mitzvah are not harmed or do not encounter any damage. So the question arises, what's the concept behind that? Well, what is that, some kind of a magical thing? That if you're involved in a mission to do a mitzvah, then you have some kind of a magical protection. I think that's the reason, if I'm not mistaken, shliach mitzvah, right? If you're going, especially when, I don't know why, when you're going to Israel, if a person, I don't know, I see if people do that. When I was in the shul and I would say that I'm going to Israel for whatever. So then people would come over and give like a dollar or whatever, shliach mitzvah geld. It makes you wait because you're going to go to Israel and you're going to give the money to tzedakah. So, well, what's the idea behind that? Is there any validity to that? What's your take? What's your questions? Thing that, well, why would it only be when you're going to Israel? I mean, if the idea is, I assume they mean protection on the trip. Of course, it's a plane ride. It's a long plane ride. But any plane ride, I assume, would be of equal. I don't think that the danger of a plane ride increases with the distance. So, but why is it only in that situation? Also, you could ask, I mean, you can make a case that just visiting Israel is a mitzvah. So why do you need anything additional? I would say also, I dare say that there's been occasions where people have gone on these types of journeys and they did encounter accidents and so forth. I'm sure, am I wrong? There's the famous story in the Gemara about the case of Acher, what transformed him into a heretic.
I told my students that case, because you can't say that 100% of the time it works.
Yeah, but I was just thinking, correct me if I'm wrong. In that case, that's the story that the father told the son to go climb to the top of a fence. And there was a little bird to send away the bird and bring down the chicks. And so the kid went up and he did it. And then he fell and he got killed. Those are the two mitzvos that specifically point out the reward will be length of days. L'man yarichan yamecha. That's said by Kibra Ve'aim. That's also said, interestingly enough, by the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, to send away the mother bird. And so here you have a case where this person fulfilled both of these mitzvahs, which promise a reward of a long life, and he died. So I think he came to the conclusion that there's no reward in punishment in this world, which is not the case. I mean, it's a whole issue. But as a result of this, he was led to heresy. But what's interesting, however, is that he did not cite the shluchei mitzvah, because you could also have made a case that the child was a shliach mitzvah. He was engaged in doing something which was a mitzvah, quite apart from the fact that that particular mitzvah mentions this as the reward. That was not brought down. Now, so I am pretty sure that there are many cases of accidents that occur, whether it be an automobile crash, other types of things that occur to people who are involved in doing a mitzvah. So if you're going to look at it that way, as sort of an ironclad guarantee that it's some protective thing, then you're going to have a problem that's contradicted by reality. Over a story I read in one of the books that the Rav Herschel Schechter wrote about the Rav. I think it's Nefesh HaRav, but I can't find it this minute. And that is that, as I recall the story, that one day the Rav was giving shiur, and the fellows could tell that he had hurt his shoulder because he was sort of holding on to his shoulder or rubbing it or whatever. It was clear throughout the shiur that he had hurt his shoulder. So after the shiur, the fellows asked him, like, what happened? So he said that the previous day, he had gone up, I believe it's to Lakewood, to visit with Rav Aaron Cutler. You all know who he is. He was a big gadol, to discuss a certain matter with him pertaining to Klal Yisrael. I don't remember. I don't know if he even mentions what the issue was. Maybe I don't remember that. And that it was an icy day, and that he had slipped on the ice and he hurt his shoulder. So the fellow said, yeah, but Shluchei Mitzvah ain't Nizukin. They asked this very question. So he answered, he says, well, I was unsuccessful. That is, he couldn't convince Rabbi. He couldn't convince Rav Cutler to go along with his point. So therefore he wasn't successful. So I find, personally, I don't think he was being serious. I think it was sort of humorous. It sounds like a humorous kind of thing. Because I'll tell you why. My understanding is, if you're a shliach mitzvah, that is, so you're an osek ben mitzvah, you're a shliach mitzvah. Let's say you're going on a trip to try and free the captives, to provide assistance for Jews in need, to intercede with the government. So that's a shliach mitzvah. And, for example, on Sukkot, you'd be pater from Sukkot, because a shliach mitzvah is pater min ha-sukkah, shluchei mitzvah. Because of osek b'mitzvah, pater min ha-mitzvah. If you're involved in one mitzvah, you're exempt from a mitzvah. So I you can tell me that, I would also imagine that this principle applies. So are you going to tell me that that depends upon whether you're successful or not? That is, if you succeed in the mission, so then you're a shliach mitzvah. But if you fail in the mission, so then you're not? I would imagine that that doesn't make any sense. Because the whole idea would be dependent upon the nature of the shlichus. You're involved in trying to fulfill a mitzvah. And it's the kind of mitzvah that's not completely under your control. You're going somewhere to return a lost object. That's a mitzvah. So it could happen that the person isn't there anymore, or you had the wrong location. Whatever it is, it could turn out that after all of that, traveling to do the mitzvah, you didn't have a chance to do it. So I don't think that that changes the status. That's not how you judge a shliach mitzvah. So therefore, I thought the Rav was basically joking. If you're going to accept the fact that the mission he was on was a mitzvah, which it seems like it was, he was traveling up to go visit Rav Aaron Cutler for something which was pertaining to the benefit of Klal Yisrael, so then that's a shliach mitzvah. And I think that he meant it sort of like a joke. But if that's the case, so what is the idea of shliach mitzvah? What's the concept? that that's an automatic, magical kind of thing. That yeah, since you're involved in doing something which is for the sake of a mitzvah, so no harm will come to you. The way I would understand it would be, of course, there's always the factor of hashgacha. That's one of the factors. But as we've been talking about, there's always, in determining outcomes, events occur because of two reasons. There are two factors. One is your own actions, which is probably the most primary and the most significant. And then there's the forces around you, the forces of nature. And by the forces of nature, it's not just, you know, the objective forces, like the wind and the rain and things like that, but then there's the social order. There's a social order, and that also has an effect on you. If there's robbers or whatever the case may be, there's the social order. So, because of that, as we said, because of that factor, because of that second factor, there's a need for a tefillah, or there's a zone, so to speak, of hashgacha. Because things that lie within your control, you don't really need hashgacha, because you can do them yourself. That's because they lie completely within your control. But the more your actions are not sufficient in and on them, unto themselves, and you have other factors which can, you know, no matter how good you do it, it's dependent upon other factors. So, of course, you have to do your role, but you need help in the other area. That's the area of hashgacha. Now, as far as the shluchei mitzvah is concerned, let's take it on both counts. Because Chazal in general are concerned about traveling. It's considered a dangerous thing, especially in those days. But even today, with all the advances in science and technology, you can't compare. You can't make any comparisons. I mean, the idea that a person gets on the plane, you know, in the morning and by evening he's in Israel, is something that people couldn't contemplate. And of course, the safety factor. But still, in all, it's still regarded as a dangerous situation, because you're exposed to many elements. Now, in terms of the shluchei mitzvah ein nizukin, I think. For example, Chazal say, Al tirgazu baderach. Yosef warned his brothers that when they returned to Canaan, not to, you know, get worked up, not to argue, get into arguments because of what had just taken place. You know, the whole revelation that this was Yosef and bringing up all of the past recriminations. These things, you see, even amongst the brothers, these things don't die so quickly. What was he concerned about? They would start getting back into that whole thing. And then they could start arguing with each other. But he mentioned specifically by Derach, because you got to be in a certain heightened state of consciousness. And you shouldn't get distracted when you're traveling, because there's much, much greater dangers that you're subjected to. And in fact, you're not, when you're driving, you go, you're not really supposed to be learning. I mean, obviously, we're talking about the driver. But he can get involved in a discussion. In a discussion with the other people in the car. And it could be the kind of discussion that really he gets, you know, mentally involved. It takes his mind off of the road. Taking your mind off of the road is very dangerous. So you know how to do that. It's a situation of, you're putting yourself into a situation of danger. Now, I mean, today we have many expressions of this. I mean, this is a whole question with texting. And not just texting, you take phone calls. I think that in many places there's a law you have to have a headset, because if you're holding the phone, it makes it more difficult. But even so, if you get involved in a serious conversation, and even if you have the headphone, the Bluetooth, whatever you want to call it, it clearly takes your mind. It does have an effect, a phone conversation. And certainly texting. I mean, that's a fact that they've had some horrible, horrible accidents. I think this affects, generally speaking, the younger one, you know, teenagers and younger people, because they text all the time. And they even text while they're driving, which means you have to take, you have to take your eyes off of the road. That's part of the problem of having a phone. Just if it rings, you got to pick it up and you got to press the button to answer it. So that's a bigger distraction whenever you take your eyes off the road, even for a short period of time. So now, one way of looking at this is that a shliach mitzvah, what I wanted to say is that there's different states of mind that we are in. There's what I would call a frivolous state of mind, or easygoing, frivolous, relaxed, you know, going for a drive. So everybody's in a certain kind of a mood, a lighthearted. It's a lighthearted type of a mood. And then there's a serious, watchful state of mind or mood. And when you're in any kind of a situation of danger, then there's not a time for a lighthearted move. You see, I mean, if it's getting dark and you're getting lost and this and that, all of a sudden everybody starts to focus and let's focus, let's concentrate, let's figure this out. You know, how many miles till we get to this place? Certainly when you're driving down a very, a winding road and, you know, it's much tougher, so then there's focus. You focus on what you're doing. Now, when you focus on what you're doing, it's not just that it gets you through that particular thing, but overall. It's not just limited to that one thing, but then it'll affect many other decisions that you have to make at that point in time, as opposed to the frivolous mood. And your frivolous mood, it's a lighthearted mood, and then you kind of feel invincible. You know, you don't worry that, because most people walk around with a certain attitude like that, that nothing bad is going to happen to them. So the logical, rational way of explaining it is that a shliach mitzvah is really focused. He's not just going on a lighthearted journey, but he's focused on performing the mitzvah. So that puts him, for a number of reasons, he wants to do the mitzvah, and his mind is serious, and he recognizes the dangers, so he will behave in a different kind of a way. And that's the idea of shliach mitzvah ein nizukin. But it's not a statement in the absolute that it can't. It's not saying that. That's merely saying that it's making a statement about the situations of danger and why people fall into situations of danger. And, it's a side benefit. It's a side benefit. Now, you could also add the factor of hashgacha. In addition but that psychological state and that attitude elevates a person and does bring him closer to Hashem because he's focused on doing a mitzvah. And that does increase the degree of hashgacha. Let's put it this way. When you speak about providence and hashgacha, you're talking about degrees. And the Rambam writes about that. So the hashgacha that pertains to someone like Avraham Avinu, it's like very rare, very few people. That doesn't mean to say that there's no hashgacha. See, I think that's a big problem for people because they tend to think of it as all or nothing. And it's not, I don't think that's the case. That is, you may have merit, you may warrant a certain degree of protection relative to your status. However, that doesn't mean like if you enter the fiery furnace, that's not going to harm you. Like that's a level that pertains to a few people, but very few. However, that you don't require that degree of divine providence to be safe on a journey. It's not like going, I mean, it's dangerous, but it's not like anything, you know, like going through a fiery furnace. Nothing like that. So now, that's the way I would explain it. Of course, the question is, so what's the teaching, though? Okay, fine. I mean, is it just stating a reality? What's the teaching? So fine, I explained it. I explained it in a rational way. And because I explained it that way, you can't contradict me by saying, look what happened to so-and-so. Because it's not a guarantee that no bad thing can happen to you. I mean, the laws of nature are still in effect. And if you're going somewhere and it's really stormy weather and so on and so forth, and all those things, an accident occurs, it can affect you too. There's no guarantee that, you know, you're put into a safety box where nothing can harm you. So it's making a statement in general terms of all things being equal. Okay, in summation, what I'm saying is that if you're a shliach mitzvah, then the nature of the journey is completely different. It's in a different realm. And one that's less subject to harm for two reasons. Because of the attitude and comportment and behavior of the person. And in addition to that, there is the factor of hashgacha, which is not a guarantee, though. That's the problem, I think, that most people have. They want absolutes. But this is not an absolute. But what do you see that? You could see that. There's a different attitude and a mood, let's say, even with the family. If you're going for a vacation, so you're driving up to the country or wherever it is you go. You're driving to Florida, and we're going on vacation. So what are people doing? Everybody's happy, and they're singing all kinds of songs and so on. The celebration has begun. That's a celebratory kind of a mood, which is not the case, obviously, when you're going to something which is, let's say, it's a Dvar Mitzvah. You'll behave differently. The attitude is different. The only thing is, like I'm saying, there's no absolute guarantees here. Because accidents happen. And sometimes, you know, people drive crazily. People can drive crazily and speed and all that, and nothing happens to them. On the other hand, the person could be driving carefully, and all of a sudden, some guy came from the other side, and he had to swerve to avoid him, and he got into a bad accident. That's because of the fact that you can't control. Like I said, there's many things that are outside of your control, which I do believe, however, even those things, you can sometimes, you know, it's what we call a close call. You'll see sometimes you'll have a close call and you'll escape, but you realize it could have been real bad. But you'll also realize that it's because you were really focused. You weren't speeding crazily. You were concentrating. So you made the right decision. And also you were in another thing. Another cause of accidents that we're talking about driving is people really shouldn't be driving. They're tired. They're starting to, you know, their eyes are starting to close or doze, whatever. You have to consider your state. It's not just, you know, how to drink while under the influence of alcohol. The same should be true. Because there's many other states in which you're not really functioning up to par. So that's another thing. So I would say as follows, if I had to conclude with some kind of a lesson, I think it's an opportunity. Chazal wanted to alert you to the tremendous benefits that you could get from doing a mitzvah. In other words, that you shouldn't just be perfunctory. that when you set out to do a mitzvah, you should think about it and consider it and put your mind and your heart into what you're doing. And that will, not because as a result you won't get hurt. That is the end result, and that's the thing that catches people's mind. It's true. But the reason why they're emphasizing that, and so what's the purpose? You know, why will... the reason I believe why they're emphasizing that is so that your whole approach to mitzvahs will be affected. And if a person has that proper approach, then the greatest benefit will be from the performance of the mitzvah. Because a lot of times people have mitzvahs, and they're going on a journey to do a mitzvah, but how much benefit are you going to get out of it? I mean, you can just go through the motions and do it perfunctorily, and so on and so forth. But a person should recognize that that's a whole new type of a phenomenon. And it should elevate his appreciation of mitzvahs, and the fact that he has the opportunity to do the mitzvah. Then he'll be in a very serious state. It'll be something he really wants to do, and he really wants to carry it out the right way. So when that's the case, the whole journey will be different. He'll take along what he needs and so on. He'll plan carefully, and he'll be in a certain elevated state. He'll be in a certain heightened focus state. Now, I just thought of a connection between this and the story of the Megillah. Think about, because I've been reading, there's a new Megillah out with the commentary of the Rav. The commentary of the Rav is, like over 90% of it, is taken from one of his books, which is Festival of Freedom, which talks about Hanukkah and Purim. So, which I've been reading, but also then they put it in the form of commentary. So, I mean, I think it's valuable because it's good to have it right in front of you. So one of the questions that he asks is a very good question. Because when she finally agreed to go before Ahasuerus, so she said that gather all the Jews and they should all fast for me for 3 days, night and day. And I too, and my maidens will fast also. And thus, I will go to the king, you know, against the law, in violation of the law. And if I'm lost, I'm lost. So now he asks the question, but why did she do that? She was a beautiful woman. And obviously that was going to be a significant factor. That hopefully when the king would see her, he'd feel the love for her. And therefore he would, you know, stretch out the scepter and live. And see, saying, if that's the case, why should she do that? After 3 days and three nights of fasting, I mean, you're in a really weakened state. Soldiers at war, you know, you violate everything. Shabbos. Even if it's Yom Kippur, you have to, you need your strength, so you eat. I mean, the Yom Kippur war, I mean, a lot of, because it's so ingrained in Jews, you know, to fast on Yom Kippur, that many Jews will do so even if it's a dangerous situation, but according to Halacha, you're supposed to, I mean, unless you just don't need to eat or whatever, but if you need your strength, then you don't fast. So she's going to see the king. He's saying she should have, like, for the 3 days, taken care of her body and anointed herself with whatever, the perfumes, and eaten properly, so she'd be in the best possible condition to be there, you know, to confront the king. That's what you should fast, because they're not... They have to fast and do tshuva and so forth. But she doesn't. So it does say that it would appear that she went, doesn't mention if she took anything, but it would appear that she just she did put on, she did dress up in royalty. That she had to do. But he wanted to say along these lines that, see, he was attracted to her because of her chen, her charm. And the Rav says, it doesn't mean she was necessarily the most physically beautiful woman. Well, could be Vashti was more beautiful from the physical standpoint. I mean, I would say she was beautiful, but we've always spoken about this. There is a certain inner beauty. There are people that radiate a certain beauty, a certain charm that captivates other people. Now, hers had to do, it was of a spiritual kind. That, I mean, it's hard to depict. That, but you've seen it, you know, a certain serenity, a certain strength, a certain intelligence. You meet people like that. And they, I mean, assuming that they're okay looking or good looking, but it heightens. I mean, it's a tremendously attractive thing. So after the 3 days in which she contemplated and she did tshuva, and so she elevated herself to such a spiritual level that's in that state of consciousness and clarity, she, so to speak, radiated that beauty, that charm. You see, he was completely smitten when he saw her. So that's the connection that I'm suggesting. I'm sort of, maybe it's a bit of a stretch, but I'm connecting the two. That the idea of shluchei mitzvah, that a person should contemplate and shouldn't just do the mitzvah in a haphazard fashion. Now you see, because Esther approached it that way, she came up with, you see, in the case of Esther, that's another point that we've made and the Rav makes, that she did not, Mordechai was the catalyst who activated her, that she has to make this move, and she can't wait to get an appointment with the king. We've discussed this many times, that it was essential that she do something dramatic, which would entail putting her life on the line. So that is, in itself is a very significant teaching. But she did not listen to Mordechai. Simply said to go and to plead, essentially, you know, make this dramatic move. And when the king, if he grants you the opportunity to present your request, so then just plead. That did not sit well with her. She began to contemplate. She spent those 3 days in contemplation, and she realized that it just wouldn't work. And we've discussed, we've gone into that many, many times. As tempting as that seems, those kinds of things are not going to work. Because you have to understand what's going on. The role that Haman plays, and the fact that the king already gave out a decree. So you can make a big, you can plead, and so on and so forth. What's your plan? I think there's a lesson for us as well. That in many of these situations, you know, we're in a tough spot, whatever the problem might be, and we really need help. And so we identify whether it's a politician or whether it's some big doctor, if it's a medical, you know, so finally you go to this person. But what you're going to ask for is not so simple. But when you're under the grip of that emotion, it's sort of automatic that, I'm just going to plead. I'll cry, I'll plead. And I mean, look, there are certain situations where that'll work, but there are situations where that's just not going to be enough. Because there are situations where you got to stop and you got to have a plan. Because you have to consider what you're up against. What you're up against and what the problems would be. And you've got to find an opening. So Mordechai, Look, I don't know. When Mordechai said to go and plead before the king, whether he meant specifically just go, he hadn't apparently thought it through. He had not apparently thought it through. This, well, the whole plan of the two parties and all of that, he hadn't thought that through. That was something, I mean, Esther knew Ahasuerus better and how he works and what his fears are and so on and so forth. It was extremely bold, a brilliant kind of a plan. So you could see what she was involved in. Now, when a person is in that state, sometimes you reach a certain state. It's like an elevated state of consciousness. I believe everyone has experienced it at certain points in time. It's sort of an elevated state of consciousness, a certain sort of state of clarity. So in that state, that's better than a state of going to the spa and relaxing and getting this treatment and the other treatment, you know, and this perfume and this thing and that thing. It's a whole, you know, it's a whole different state of mind. And it's not the same person. It's not the same person. Then you're going to, now for some women who basically that's all they have is their, a different kind of charm, you know. It's the more the charm of sensuality and flirtatiousness and so forth. But her charm was totally different. So now take that back over here. You see that she acted. It was basically, I mean, you could say it was basically a level of Ruach HaKodesh. That she acted that way. The way that she acted was not in the normal way people act. She raised herself to a higher level. And things happened. Things happened. And that night, the king couldn't sleep. So now I would connect that with this concept of Shluchei Mitzvah. That a person should recognize the great, great significance of what he's about to undertake and should seek to maximize it to the highest possible level. Because you may just be going. You're going. So what? I'm going to come and I'm going to ask. I'm going to have an appointment with the governor and I'm going to make an appeal to him, an emotional appeal to let this guy. Yeah, but that's not a plan. You should be involved when you're a shliach mitzvah. You should be involved in the mitzvah. And don't just say, I'm going through the motions. But really think it through and contemplate, and doors can open for you. And that puts you in a completely different state of mind. So now it's not just a matter of the safety precautions. That's for sure. But you're operating on a completely different plane, akin to the plane of Esther during the 3 days and subsequently. So then you're going to be likely to succeed. You're going to be likely to succeed in the doing of the mitzvah. So that, I think, is the teaching and the takeaway. Next question had to do with the hanging of the 10 sons of Haman. Is that? I think that the hanging, I'm pretty sure, if you go through the psukim, they didn't execute them by hanging. They killed them, and then they hung them. So, of course, the question is why. They were dead already. And my take is that, hanging a person is a tremendous degradation. It's like one of the worst ways. When they're killed by hanging, it's not just to kill, it's also the degradation, as opposed to shooting a person or whatever. That's just execution. Today they give a lethal injection. So the purpose, in my opinion, was Mechias HaMalek. The Haman represented Amalek. I mean, that was the whole reason why Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. So the mitzvah is to destroy the Zecher. Okay, now that means to degrade. There are certain things where it's a mitzvah to degrade. it mentions when you come into the land, and it says that all of the various things you should destroy. It's in Devarim. You know, their altars and so on and so forth. And Rashi mentions that you should degrade it, give them a name which is degrading. So there is a mitzvah of degradation when it comes to idolatry. And the worst idolatry is the idolatry of man. That's essentially Amalek. So the war that they fought and the victory they attained wasn't just that the Jews were saved, but they achieved a great victory over Amalek. And I think that that's what Esther wanted to do, that she wanted to make that point that this is special, this is unique, this is different, and this is something which has to be eradicated. And the attitude that a person should have towards this kind of a thing, it's kind of like the Nazis. That's like a dirty word. And, you know, it gets hurled around too much. And, of course, the enemies of the Jews like to throw it back at them because they want to, you know, they don't want to feel guilty about what they did, so they want to say, you're the Jews. But you know, everybody recognizes that that's already going nuclear when you use that term. You're very, very careful. So I think that's the main idea. Now, as far as the sons of Haman, yeah, they weren't righteous at all. And they were completely behind him. They were totally behind. If they were tzaddikim and they didn't go along with his ideology and so forth, so they wanted to kill them. To the contrary. I mean, Germans, they were righteous Germans. And, well, we didn't have really a Jewish king to take revenge on the Germans, but if there was at that time, then you know, they would have punished the Nazis, but those who rejected Hitler, who didn't join, they wouldn't have been, there's no reason to punish them. They're not Amalek. So obviously there's no question that they were like leaders in this whole movement and supporters. So that's part of the downfall. It's not, because you could ask, why these 10? But it's like the same thing with Paro, the firstborn. I mean, the utter defeat of an individual is expressed not just when he dies, but all of his children. He had 10 sons. So for all of them, and all of them were wicked, for all of them, that's a real destruction. The fact that he himself dies, that's one thing. But his children survive. But the fact that not just him, but all of his sons were killed, and that has to be, that's presume nisa, it has to be publicized. But I'm saying it's publicized in a way which also carries with it the tremendous degradation. And that's part of the mitzvah, to degrade Amalek. Esther is adding that the very pasuk itself says that after the first party, when he was enraged that Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him, and he gathered together his wife and his friends and so forth, and he was bragging to them about all of his achievements and the kvod ashrod, the honor of his wealth, for rov banav, and his many sons, so that, you see, that was an entity. He wouldn't have bragged about them if they rejected his philosophy. That means to say that I've instilled this, whatever it is, this ideology in his 10 sons. So that's indicating that they were all part of the same thing.